Hi folks, hope all is well. This is Jim Carr saying hello and welcome you to the latest Bantercast, the weekly podcast from the team behind the Banter series of talks and events. At Banter, we put on events in spaces and venues of all shapes and sizes. We invite a range of interesting people to come along to tell their stories, talk about their lives and discuss various topics and themes. We record what happens in the room and then we podcast the results. Seeing as we'll be back at the Big Grill Festival later this summer, here's one from last year's adventures with the Meat Eaters and Barbecue Fiends in Dublin 4. Neil Rankin is a chef, cookbook writer and restaurant dude behind a host of great joints including Smokehouse, Temper, Pit Q, Bad Egg and many more. He joined us to talk about his career, from early days as a sound engineer for various bands to his current run of success as the man with the restaurant plan.
Hi folks, welcome to Back to Banter here at the Big Grill. Really glad to have you all here. We are joined right now by Mr. Neil Rankin. Welcome to Banter. How are you?
I'm great.
I want to go way back to the old days, the very old days. You went to college in Manchester.
Yes, Salford actually.
All right, what were you studying there?
Physics, acoustic science.
Right, so you were involved with bands, weren't you? You were involved with bands, rock bands.
No, I did. I did sound engineering.
Right.
And then after that, but it was mainly conferences and exhibitions and stuff like that. And
yeah.
I did a couple of bands.
What bands did you do?
Back then, we did Radiohead. I worked for a company called Wigwam in Manchester for a bit, and we did Radiohead. We did Coldplay when they just started. I did Oasis once. Stuff like that, but not much.
Were you like kind of front of house monitors, or were you the tech guy, the PA tech guy?
Yeah, I was the guy behind the big thing, doing all the that sort of thing.
Did you enjoy it?
It was all right. It was good. But yeah, I mean, I just kind of fell into it. I went to school and was playing in bands, and then decided to do something like that. I was good at physics, so I did. I went on to do that. Didn't really think about it.
Yeah.
It's just one of these things, decisions you make. And then I did that for about 6 years. And then opened a chain of cafes in Scotland.
All right, so this is the idea you kind of got out in Australia, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, you know quite a bit.
Dude.
it was a weird concept. When my parents were living in Australia, so I went over there, saw this concept, copied it, took it over, bought the franchise from them.
What was it?
It was a make-your-own sandwich bar. Actually, you've got one in Ireland. I think there was one in Dublin. These guys opened some in Dublin in the park.
What was the brand called, Neil?
MYO.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, there was one. I think there was guys opened it. I remember because I did a site visit with them in the sort of business park.
Yeah.
In the centre of Dublin.
In East Point Business Park.
That one.
Okay,
yeah.
Right. Okay. So how long did that dalliance with sandwiches last for?
Four or five years, and then I sold up and decided to study. I started to learn to be a chef to open a restaurant.
Okay, so let's go back to kind of like the selling of the business then. I mean, did you make enough money to wash your face?
It was 2008, so it was in the financial crash. So I was pretty lucky to get away with anything at that point. But yeah, I did. And then spent a year. I took a year out, went to culinary school, worked in sort of two Michelin, three Michelin star, one Michelin star kitchens for nothing.
Yeah.
Worked in the hardest places I could. I actually phoned up this recruitment guy and said, what's the worst kitchen to work in that you can get me into?
And that was what, the Penny Hill Park Hotel?
Yeah, working for Michael Wignall, who's a little Napoleon, basically.
You described that you kind of said in an interview previously about like asking the recruitment guy to send you to the worst kitchen going, and he sends you to Wignall's kitchen. And I looked up Wignall, a couple of videos of Wignall.
Wignall's a lovely, lovely guy. He's a great cook. He's a really good educator, but it's a tough kitchen to work in. And I wanted to work in a kitchen that, unlike a lot of the chefs nowadays that sort of start off and want the kind of easy life and, you know, want lower, you know, high paid stuff for, you know, seven shifts a week. I wanted the hard stuff to get into that and to, so that everything else after that, my life after that was kind of easy.
Yeah. And like, I'm curious, like, when you were kind of like in the Tanta Maria, what's going on behind me?
I don't know. He doesn't like it.
when you were
met Michael Wignall. I don't know. Maybe.
when you were in the Santa Maria Cooking Academy, did they prepare you for that kind of hard life?
I didn't really know what to do. You know, I'm almost 30. I'm 29 years old. And I'm going to immerse myself into kitchens and start a career all over again from scratch. So I just thought it might be wise just to sort of learn some of the basics. I don't know how much. I think in retrospect, I probably could have just worked in kitchens and learned that. But
yeah,
it was kind of nice to do it anyway. Yeah. And it was nice grounding and it was a nice easy route into it. I don't think it got me more jobs. Yeah. The jobs that got me more jobs were the stuff I did for free. I mean, I worked for a guy called Nuno Mendes, who was doing this Loft Supper Club in London.
Yeah.
And he just got this great review. So I just phoned him up and said, look, can I give you a hand? So I was just helping him out. That got me the job at Wignall's. Then Wignall's got me a job at Shea Bruce, and then Shea Bruce got me the next job, and that kind of, you know, bounced off.
Yeah.
But it's good to have a sort of background knowledge, because I knew nothing before I started.
Like, you know, I'm curious, because we interviewed Otto Lengi at Banter a few months ago, and he did something similar. I mean, he was off doing kind of like some kind of science, and he decided he was going to become a proper chef. He did the training like you just described there, and he said it was useful in learning the basics, but that was it. You actually have to actually work in a kitchen properly in order to know what's going on.
Yeah, you do. I mean, it's not really about the cooking so much. It's about the whole, you know, the working in the kitchen and learning how to prepare for stuff, learning, you know, how to get faster at doing what you're doing. You can't really learn that in a culinary school. You need to be thrown in at the deep end. And it's scary. And it's, you know, I was a 30-year-old guy working as a commis chef in a 2 Michelin-star kitchen with a 17-year-old girl telling me what to do all day and shouting at me. You know, it's quite a hard pill to swallow. But you've just got to have a, you know, backbone and just go to it and just go, look, this is because I want to do this.
Yeah. So, like, you know, at that stage then, you're going through all the classic stages to becoming kind of like on the Michelin road. You're doing all these kind of, you're in these different kitchens, you're kind of working your way along. And then you come across a guy called Adam Perry Lang.
Yeah, it was weird. I was working for Gary Rhodes at the time in the city. And there was an advert in the newspaper that Jamie Oliver's opened this restaurant. And I'd just been reading about this guy in Restaurant Magazine the day before. And I was like, this could be quite interesting. I went along to the interview. And they were just like, yeah, absolutely. When do you want to start? And I didn't really know. I researched the guy. And I'd never really cooked barbecue food before. But the one thing that really frustrated me in kitchens back then was in all the Michelin star places, the meat that we were actually buying was pretty terrible. And it was all butchered before we got it. And, you know, even the fish that we got in, Gary Rhodes was actually better. We could buy whole fish in and learn how to fillet stuff. But because of the pressure and the time pressure you're under, and because of their numbers, I mean, I think the misconception that a lot of people have about fine dining food is that the produce is better in fine dining places. I don't really think it is. I mean, the produce that we did in Picky was way, way, way better than 2 Michelin-star places that we were working in, you know. And we're not attracting, you know, you're not paying the price for it, but we hope to get volume out of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's curious what you say then about, like, being the 2 Michelin-star experience when it comes to the ingredients, because most of us kind of assume that, like, I mean, the money you're paying for that kind of thing has been spent on the ingredients.
I mean, it's good. It's as good as. I mean, I'm not saying it's crap by any means, but in general, it's not any better than the good casual dining good places in London at the moment, or even here. You know, we're buying, you know, like the beef we're selling today, like the Peter Hannon stuff and the stuff that's kind of top drawer. And we've got the same in London and we all buy it. What you're paying for in a Michelin star place is the number of people serving you. You know, you've got, you know, and you say something like the Fat Duck, you've got 40 chefs to 40 customers. You know, that's what you're paying for. You're paying for all this little precision and little details and all this work that goes into it. I mean, I used to spend in 2 Michelin-star places, I'd be like, I'd spend about 3-4 hours on beetroot, you know?
Okay, yeah. So 3-4 hours again.
Whether
your hands
or not that in your sense is worth it, but that's where the money's going. Whereas my guys in Smokehouse will spend maybe 20 minutes in beetroot, you know?
Yeah.
And it's more about the produce just getting delivered and how we cook it, rather than dicing it into some stupid little tiny mirepoix or anything, you know.
Yeah. Okay, go back to Adam then. Like, I mean, when you started working with him, like at Jamie's place, you know, what was his approach to cooking that kind of got you going?
He was just it was just the cooking with fire and cooking with coal just kind of grabbed me. It was something that, you know, with the Michelin places, you're sticking stuff in water baths and, you know, and it's all very precise but very boring to do, you know. I mean, there's essentially a guy on the pass that would have the meat section, and he would have like six different timers and these little bags, and he's like boom, and then tsh, and then it goes ding, and then he pulls it out, and then some guy fries it, and it's like, it's not exciting cooking whatsoever. Yeah. The exciting part of that is the fact that you're constantly getting shouted at, which is actually, it's all right. It's, you know, I think a lot of people take issue with it. I don't think it's the right way to do it. I don't do it in my kitchens, but there is a certain sense that when you're a young chef and that, it's quite exciting.
Yeah, of course, because I mean, you don't know any better when you're kind of 17, 18, but you, at this stage, you'd lived a bit, so you were kind of like, you knew your own mind at this stage.
I think it was different. I mean, I when I joined these places, I was kind of given responsibility before I was good, because I was older, you know, because everybody else is 18, 19 and doesn't really know, you know, what to do, so kind of people, because I was the same age as Michael, you know, that he would kind of give me a little bit more responsibility. But also the double-edged sword, because actually, if I wasn't very good at doing something, I'd be, you know, it would be more disappointing for them, yeah, you know. Yeah. And I wasn't very good to start. I made a lot of mistakes. I almost burned Nuno's house down. I was terrible at Shea Bruce. I was crap to start with. And it wasn't until I just... You know, at some point it clicks, and it's like a sport, it's like anything. At some point you're cooking something, you just try something else, and you go the extra bit, and you just get good at it. Okay. And so then it's easy.
And that for you obviously was kind of like, I mean, was barbecuing, was grilling.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the kitchen at Barbacoa, when we opened, the grill station was the hardest place I've ever worked in my life. I mean, that's 11 hours a day, you're sitting in front of a roaring hot fire. It's just charcoal. It's about, you know, it's 400 degrees just there, you know. I don't know what it is there. Your face is burning off. Your arms are singed, so you can just smell burning hair as you're doing it. You're sweaty. It's hot. You know, the air conditioning doesn't really work in there. And you've got 800 covers to do. So at that one time, any one time, I've got about 50, 60 steaks. A screen of stuff saying medium rare, 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 medium, you know, and you've got to keep up with that. It's really, really intense. It's beyond anything that I did in any of the sort of better places. Yeah. I mean, that's, yeah, it's serious.
Yeah. But like, aside from what you described there, there's also a fun side to it.
Yeah, once you get at the end of it, so like it's, I think chefing's all about like hard service. The end of the night is just when that becomes worthwhile.
Yeah, yeah.
During it, it's like, God, this just never going to end.
Yeah, you said earlier on you didn't have much experience of barbecuing before Barbacoa came along. So, like, I mean, did you go on some road trips? Did you decide to kind of like check out what the Dons were doing, or were because a quote you have, which you said that, like, I mean, people always regard kind of barbecue as an American style thing. You were more interested to see what you could do with Mexican, Korean, and Thai food.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what the food I was eating. I lived in New Malden in southwest London, which is sort of a Korean area. It's got really high population of Korean people, loads of Korean restaurants, and then moved to places. London's all little villages around it, and there's always, like, a sort of set ethnicity that, you know, that comes with that. So there's places where there's lots of Thai restaurants, there's places lots of Vietnamese restaurants, and you get immersed in that. And that's what I was eating. I didn't get time to travel because I didn't have time for holidays. So you're just eating the food that people are giving you. So when I go into a kitchen and do my own thing, the likelihood is that that's what I'm going to be cooking, or that's what's going to inspire me.
So, like, I mean, post Barbacoa, then, I mean, you set up, you kind of like, you went through a couple of places. There was kind of, there was Smokehouse. There was also John Salt, wasn't there?
Yeah, John Salt was the first thing I did after PickQ.
Okay.
So we opened PickQ. PickQ was massive. I mean, it was just, we didn't, it was a kind of a weird decision because a lot of people think that it was a really sort of gift that I got the head chef job there to open it. But it was a trailer in the South Bank. Yeah. Serving pulled pork buns and opening a place. And I was there working for Jamie Oliver as sous chef of an 800-cover restaurant, getting paid, you know, £15 an hour working so 85 hours a week, so I was making quite a lot of money. And to take that job was actually less money, and it also didn't, you know, it wasn't guaranteed to be successful.
Yeah. So what attracted you to Richard Turner then the first time you saw him?
His manly looks. It's like a bear, isn't he?
He's like a big bear. Yeah, like a big bear. Huggable bear. But, like, no, but I'm curious about this because it's like, you know, you've also kind of dealt with other kind of businessmen, and this is the thing about London, right? London, when it comes to food industry, you sometimes kind of feel it's just loads of money.
I met Richard when I was doing this pop up called Beef Cartel with this guy called Niall Davison, actually an Irish guy who worked as butcher in Barbacoa. And what he was doing is he was buying these 15-year-old Highland cows, and we were doing a pop-up where we butchered it on site and just cooked the whole cow over 3 nights. So it was Tom from PitQ that came in during the day and saw me with this sort of Argentinian grill and half a cow above it, just cooking it nice and slowly. And he was like, "What the hell are you doing?" And we said, "We've got this thing tonight." He then invited all of Hawksmoor down to like our first pop-up, and I had to grill like 65 steaks on a tiny little grill outside with no light, and I couldn't even see anything. And then Richard Turner showed up and was like, "What the hell are you doing? Why are you doing like this?" I was like, "Oh, that's all I've got." And it went down really well, and he came up after and said, "Look, you've got something. We've got this new opportunity. Do you want to, you know, chat about it?" And then, yeah, we just went on to do PitQ, which was pretty successful.
Yeah. Okay, so like someone like Richard Turner then, like, I mean, he's got a track record. And I'm curious about, like, you know, the difference between people like him and, say, Scott Hunter, who you currently work with. You know, in terms of, like, these business people. Like, I mean, you've already got a business acumen. Don't try and deny it. Because, I mean, you had you had the franchise thing going.
Yeah, but I mean, Richard doesn't really get involved that much in the business. I mean, Richard puts people together. That tends to be what he does. So he came along. I mean, obviously, Hawksmoor that he started, and he did all this stuff. So that's the thing. And he also worked for Marco Pierre White back in the day when he got his 3 Michelin stars. So, I mean, Richard had been through it as well. There's some pictures of him actually working with Marco. He's like a stick figure with little funny hair. It doesn't even look anything like him, and little nerdy glasses. It's great. But yeah, it's, I mean, he had a background in it. He was just an interesting character, and they were all quite interesting, and that's what kind of drew me to it.
Yeah, okay. But like, I mean, I suppose I'm curious about the business side of things then. You know, I mean, you've done a few things now with Scott, you know? So, like, how do you decide these are the people you want to work with?
I didn't. Scott found me. I was working... After I left PitQ, I did this thing called John Salt in Islington, where there was a chef called Ben Spaulding who was doing it, and he was, like, the chef at the moment, and he was doing these crazy dishes. And I was speaking to the owners about another pub, and they called me up and said, "Look, this guy, everybody wants to quit. He hasn't come in for 6 days. His gross profit is nothing, minus. He's ruining our business. We just spent £1 million in it. Can you come and help us out, take over and do this instead?" Which was kind of daunting, because even though this guy clearly was not a business genius, his food was getting really good reviews, so it was a weird thing to take over. But it also kind of highlighted what I was good at. So because I made a success of it, because we got like 5 out of 5 in Evening Standard the next day, and 4 out of 5 in Independent, and all these rave reviews. And he was doing 30 covers a night. We went to doing 140, and we were booked out for months. So it was a good thing to do. But it was a scary decision. And then Scott came in. He was just at there 3 or 4 times, and he said, "Look, I've just bought this pub around the corner. I don't know what to do with it. I'd quite like to do something with barbecue and cooking. Can you come and have a look at it?" And he brought in with him was this the executive chef from Noma, who was just kind of like, I was a little fanboy, so it was quite a good way of buttering me up. And we went together, had a look at this place, and I was like, "Yeah, let's do it."
Okay, what's that become?
That was Smokehouse.
That's Smokehouse. Okay, so like, I mean, but since then as well, you've also kind of like done that diner place, Bad Egg, as well.
Oh, I don't want to talk about that.
Okay, let's. that like no, but like let's talk about that. That was a fucking weird concept.
It wasn't a weird concept.
It wasn't
a weird concept. We were gonna open a fucking diner. And it was supposed to be a diner. And then I did an interview with the Daily Mail, and they said we called it Bad Egg just because, I don't know, I was drunk and I thought it was a good name, and everybody else agreed, and we couldn't come up with it. Names in restaurants is really hard. Yeah. That's why everything's called like Tavern and stuff like that now, and everybody's got this thing. Everybody goes to these like logical names now, because coming up with a restaurant, it's like it's the most annoying thing, because you get people just coming up with suggestions all the time. Oh, how about this, you know? Yeah. So we settled on that. We all liked it. And then the Daily Mail phoned me up and said, look, I'd like to do a piece in it. Is this restaurant based on eggs? And I was like, no, absolutely not. It's just a diner. So the headline was, Neil Rankin opens egg-based restaurant. Oh, shit. And, of course, what happens in the media is nobody really phones you to research it, as you know. They just snowball. So it was then in the Mirror, it was then in the Telegraph, it was then in the Independent. It was like, and then it was some weird Turkish thing. It was in a paper in Turkey. And I had to get someone to translate. It was like Neil Rankin's egg hero or something like that. And I was like, what? I got called an egg pervert. Which my ex-wife phoned me up and was like, what is this? I was like, I don't know. I said, I promise you I've never done anything with eggs. not as far as I know.
But you like it? You like eggs?
Yeah, no, they're lovely. And there was a fair number of eggs in the menu anyway. I mean, it's a diner, so there is, you know, it's kind of what it is. But so when we opened up, we kind of got abuse. We got all these negative reviews because people were saying there's not enough eggs in the menu for an egg-based restaurant. And we're like, but it's not like an egg-based restaurant. And we didn't really have PR at the time, so we actually had to hire a PR, which cost us like £3,000 a month to try and dilute this image that we had. But in the end, we were like, oh, fuck it, let's just make it an egg-based restaurant. So we did all these other egg dishes and put it on the menu. And it was like, it was just a bloody nightmare. So it wasn't supposed to be weird at all. It was just supposed to be a bloody diner. And it ended up being this weird egg. And then Soho House, who just go around basically copying loads of ideas, copied it. They did this egg break or something like that. They were like, are they doing an egg-based restaurant? I was like, people were like, you're copying you. I was like, no. They didn't copy me because I didn't do an egg restaurant. I even got I was the ambassador for Great British Eggs as well. They phoned me up and they're like, can you do this? I was like, oh, sort of. How much are you going to pay? And they gave me this number. I was like, yeah. I shot myself in the foot with that. But I was like, oh, bloody hell, that's a lot of money.
But the business is still going okay?
That's going fine. I mean, I'm no longer involved with any of them now. So,
How quickly did you move on from things, Neil?
Well, that wasn't a decision. Scott, who owns it with Maria, they were pregnant. The most unlikely couple ever to have a baby, because they said they never would. And we had this. They had this plan to roll everything out, and then it got halted because of that, and because of another couple of other issues. And it wasn't a bad thing. It was, I think, to roll out Smokehouse was a bad idea, because it was very individual. It's very hard work. You know, it's not an easy thing to roll out. We're buying in whole animals. We're buying in, you know, we're doing things in a certain way. And to try and to move that to Chiswick and to try and do it all over, seem to, you know, you've got to get really specialist people in there. Otherwise, it gets diluted. I like to do new things. So I like to reinvent it and keep on reinventing stuff. So the idea for me to do exactly the same mirror copy again and again and again is just gets a bit boring, because that's not really what I'm into.
I mean, that goes back in some ways to like me, where you came into food in the first place with the franchise idea, because sometimes it strikes me that when people repeat things like that, they do go down that route a little bit.
Yeah. And I guess, but the franchise thing was different. I wasn't really working. I mean, I was, you know, it's not really, you know, you don't put your all into something like that. Okay. You know, you put all into the business side of it and raising money and stuff like that.
Right.
Serving sandwiches, it's kind of hard to get that passionate about putting vegetables on a tray, you know.
Okay, I'll think of that next time I'm down the deli counter getting a chicken steak roll.
Suppose you look at the staff, are they enlightened? Probably not. I don't, you know.
Okay, moving on then. Like, I mean, is temper the next step then, or has it been something since Smoke?
Yeah, so I had this idea for years, and we were going to do it with Scott and that, because they weren't moving on, we decided not to. And they've got six restaurants now, so, you know, six restaurants for a married couple with a kid, is kind of enough, you know. And he was just like, look, and he was quite fat. He was like, look, I'm this age. We're having this kid, you know, I don't really want to spend the next 5 years going through the stress of opening restaurants, which is a massive stress. I mean, Scott, when he opened Bad Egg, actually had to project manage it because our project manager's pulled out. He was in there learning about how to do electricity and how to, you know, do that. You know, he was in there every single day, and the stress does affect you. So for him doing that, it just wasn't happening. So I ended up, this guy that I met in the city, he said, look, I want to help you fund this restaurant. We started doing it. We actually raised the money. We got a site in Soho. And then I kind of got cold feet with him. I didn't end up trusting him. Yeah. Over a couple of issues. And so the guys that were going to sell us the site, David Coffer Lyons, this property group, put me in touch with their property division, sort of money raising division, which was a bit weird. I ended up in this sort of really ultra ultra fancy room in London that was, I don't know, I think some king or something had his wedding in there and met all these, you know, I'm there in a baseball cap and covered in charcoal and sitting in this like horribly nice room, and all these people coming in and saying, look, who do you want to invest in? At this person, this person, this person, this person. So they actually got me linked up with these other guys. They came on board, and we met quite a few times, and they said, they offered me money to do it, to raise the capital. But in doing that, I had to come out of Smokehouse because I can't have shareholdings in another restaurant when I'm raising money for another one, because nobody's going to invest in that, and that seems fair. Yeah. So we just parted companies fairly mutually and fine. I mean, you know, we still go out for drinks and. Okay.
So then, like, I mean, in terms of the new restaurant, how, like, I mean, obviously you know what exactly what it is in your head right now. Are you at liberty to talk about it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, so temper.
Yeah, no, I mean, our press release comes out this. I think the Evening Standard thing comes out Monday. But yeah, we're talking about it now.
Well, did I read somewhere that it's Mexican based?
It's not. Oh. There are things we're doing. We're doing, actually, there was a guy here yesterday selling me tacos. We're doing this Nixtamali taco thing, which nobody really knows what it is because nobody does it. Basically, when you make corn tacos, most people over here will buy the flour, this masharina, which is sort of like ground down corn that's been cooked in lime. But the real way to do it is actually to buy the corn itself, the stuff called field corn, which we don't get over here, which is dry. And you cook it in this lime, and then you grind it, wet grind it, so it comes out as a dough, and then you cook it straight away. And the flavor difference in that is just unbelievable. So I went to this place in New York that did it, and I've been to a couple of other places that do it.
What's the place in New York?
It's called Nixtamal, and it's in Queens.
All right.
I went there twice, actually. I went there one day at, like, 6 o'clock in the morning, got up at 4 o'clock and went there and it was closed. But and then I got there the next day. But the difference in texture is, like, unbelievable.
Okay, right. So that's opening in November.
So, yeah, so the idea of the restaurant, we're doing whole animal barbecue. So we're buying in whole carcasses, whole cows, whole pigs, whole goats, whole lambs, and cooking them mainly apart from the cow, which we break into different parts. But the idea is to kind of buy the best, source from direct from farms, so I cut out the middleman, and use 100% of everything. I mean, there's a lot of people talk about nose to tail,
yeah,
but it's not really nose to tail, because most of the restaurant industry survives. And say if I wanted to put short ribs on my menu, I've got to buy, and there's only 2 short ribs per cow, you know, there's only 2 sections in each cow. So something like, you know, like a barbecue place you go to, if they're selling 100 short ribs in a day, that's, you know, that's 50 cattle that they're going through just for that one, you know, your one dish. That kind of stuck in my throat a bit when I was cooking at Smokehouse. It kind of gets me. It's like, why are we doing this, you know? And also, you don't really know where it's coming from. If you look at the industry today, it's you I mean, the meat we're cooking, I know it comes from Peter Hanna, and I know where he gets it from. This, you know, some of them. But in general, most restaurants buy in, and this comes back to the Michelin star place we were talking as well. They'll just buy in bulk orders of stuff, and you don't know where that's from. I mean, they might say, you know, oh, it's this breed, it's this breed. Like, most of them don't know. But if you go to a farm, and I've got five farms I deal with, I know exactly what that cow. I know the cow's mother. I know its father. I know how old it is. I know what its attitude was like. I know when it was killed. I know when it was born. I know everything, you know, about this cow. So, and sometimes it's not as good. Sometimes it's as good. But the it's just the knowledge of that just sort of settles me a bit. And also, it means I'm going through less animals to do what I do. Yeah. And there's no waste. You know, we're going to use the bones for stock. We're going to use the fat to make the tortillas. We're going to use fats and butter. We're going to use every single element of the cow. Apart from that, we can use all the offal, all this. You know, I mean, every single thing will go on the menu. And it's just, it's a nicer way to do it, I think.
Do you reckon as well, Neil, that like punters are now at a situation, a stage where in their education, where they appreciate that, where they understand that, they understand that sometimes it like, I mean, if you've got that, if you're using kind of like, I mean, five different farms to source your cattle, it means that there's a greater awareness in terms of traceability, where it's coming from, provenance.
Yeah. And also, I mean, this argument, there's a lot of backlash against meat at the moment from this sort of factory farming ideal. And it's frustrating being in Britain because actually most of our stuff's grass-fed. And if you go to these where these cows are raised, it's not this hellhole that you think it is. I mean, the cows are just grazing on grass. It's like a big field like this, and you can probably hardly even see the cows. And, you know, the environmental impact is nil. You know, these cows are fertilizing the soil. You know, you talk about water content. They're just drinking water from the stream. You know, there's nothing going into this. You know, there's nothing. There's no spookiness. America is a different prospect. America's like, it's like trying to grow wine in Scotland. You know, that's kind of what it is. You know, you shouldn't be doing it in places you can't do it. You know, you don't force industry in somewhere where you can't do it. And America has cheap corn, so they feed it on corn. Cows can't digest corn. So you have to have a cornfield that then feeds the cow and then does this and that. That's where the water content argument comes from. So, I mean, I kind of think that, and I get it as well, people going, oh, I can't believe you're doing more meat restaurants, it's environmentally damaging. Well, it's not, you know, not the one I'm doing. And I kind of feel that, you know, rather than bastardizing the entire industry, you should be promoting the people that are doing it right and doing it well. And there are some. And yes, it means that if the big producers go down, then the price of meat, beef will go up. But then point of fact, people will be eating less beef. So then that kind of works out. You know, that's kind of the end result. It's not eating no beef. But yeah. And as well, I mean, you know, America is such a huge thing, and now China's getting involved. So China's buying loads and loads of beef and loads of lamb, and that's when America's growing it for them, and then they're destroying the rainforest and doing this. That's hellish, you know. I mean, it is really hellish, and I'm totally fundamentally against it. I'm all for eating less meat and having a more balanced diet and just buying good beef and you knowing where it comes from.
Yeah, okay. Last question for me, and thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate you giving up some time to come over and talk to us today. Last question. I mean, I've noticed in a couple of interviews, you've been name-dropping, and you give kind of a shout-out most times to Quality Chop House up in Farringdon. You know, and like I when I lived in London back in the 90s, that was one of my favourite places to go. It's amazing to see that like all 16, 17 years on, it's still consistent. Do you think consistency is something that, like, I mean, we underlook sometimes in restaurants?
I think people miss the point of opening restaurants. People miss the point of serving people food. The chef-driven sort of ideology we got at the moment there, people want to cook food because it's impressive. People want to cook food because I'm showing off and I'm doing this new technique. It's like, it's about, restaurants for me are about deliciousness, hospitality, and fun. You know, it's about having fun. It should be fun to go out to eat. It should be enjoyable. It shouldn't be, you know, this sterilized environment where you feel like, oh shit, should I wear a tie? Is this all right? And this guy's pouring the thing. It's like, oh, thank you very much. Or women getting served before men, because I don't know why that happens. I mean, they're not hungrier. You know, it's this with this weird sort of old school restaurant ideology that's very sexist, very weird, very sterile, very thing. And the more that that gets kicked out, I think the better. And I think just places like Quality Chop House, which are just about sitting down, having a nice glass of wine and somebody cooking you some nice food, is great, you know? And it's just nice and it's consistent and it's lovely. And people miss that. And I think this whole range of new chef restaurants where people serve raw peas and cheese and stuff like that, it's just, it gets a bit boring, you know. I'm just a bit bored of it myself, and tasting menus that last for 6 hours, it's like I don't want to spend 6 hours anywhere, you know. Maybe in bed, that's the only place I want to spend that amount of time. But being in a restaurant for that time and just having to sit there and getting really drunk and eating tiny little plates of food for it just isn't fun to me. I just like to go out in places, enjoy it, and have a drink and have a laugh and then go to the pub afterwards or whatever. And it's just, you know, I want more of that.
Thank you very much for your time. Neil Rankin, everybody.
Thank you, Chip.
Thanks so much. That was great. I really enjoyed that. That was
Thanks to Neil for joining us at Banter, and to Andy Noonan and all the Big Grill for their help with this event. The Bantercast series producer is Tanya White. Check out thisisbanter.com for news or update Banter. Plus, you can also listen back there to all the Banter podcasts to date. We'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, goodbye and take care.